The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A flashpoint from Africa to report as we still observe the repercussions from the Friday attacks in Paris. As we've reported, gunmen stormed the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, Mali, a group which claims affiliation with Al-Qaeda but is part of a localized insurgency in Mali and northwest Africa, took nearly 140 people hostage at one point. Hours later, Malian special forces with French and U.S. forces involved in some unspecified way cleared the hotel and freed the hostages, although dozens of people have been killed. Mali has seen this kind of thing before. Militants actually seized territory in the northern part of the country until President François Hollande ordered hundreds of French troops into the region in early 2013. Today, a standoff ends, and continued talk of closed borders and heightened security around the world. Rob writes us on Facebook, blaming the victims rather than the perpetrators is emotional-charged political demagoguery and is extremely dangerous and deadly to people and nations as a whole. Carolyn writes on our site, freedom is very important, and it is disarming to people who have not experienced it when ISIS frightens everyone, including governments, to the point that people in free and democratic countries are bent in fear, then the enemy has won. ISIS or ISIL or Daesh, whatever you call them, does fear of them constitute a victory? Is a military option exactly what ISIS wants from the West? Recognition through confrontation. In that case, this may be the opening. The Pope has called this new violence a new piecemeal Third World War. Gideon Rockman is chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. Gideon, is the Pope right?
Personally, I would try to avoid that kind of language because I think it plays into the hands of the group themselves, Islamic State, who have very grandiose views of themselves and would like to believe that they're engaged in a global struggle against the West, against infidels, or however you want to put it. I mean, but that said, I think that obviously there is something that is a global problem now. We've seen the attacks in Paris. There are also attacks going on in Mali as I speak on Friday. There are the terrorism problems clearly in the Middle East. The Russian plane was downed in Sinai just a week before the attacks in Paris. But I mean, if you think about it, really all the major powers have a problem with Islamist terrorism. So America was hit on 9/11. The Indians were hit in Mumbai in 2008 in an attack that was very similar to Paris. The Chinese would claim that they too have a problem with Islamist terrorism in Xinjiang. So there is clearly a global aspect to this problem, but I wouldn't dignify it with the phrase Third World War.
Let's look at it in three different ways here. And it seems to me that there are basically three different ways of looking at this. On the one hand, you can view this as a military tactical encounter with a group that's centered in the Middle East. And so therefore, if you somehow strangle it in the Middle East, you'll reduce its ability to do anything in a coordinated way. And that's kind of conventional war. And the second way of looking at this is to see it as a kind of broad criminality. That essentially the 21st century is going to be filled with a sort of, you know, crime wave that includes this kind of terrorism from a variety of sources, and they may seem like they're all part of one conspiracy someday, and the next day they're going to be just whoever can get their hands on AK-47s at any given moment, and that the world is just going to have to deal with that. And then the third way of looking at this is that there's some kind of realignment where the Muslim world or the allegedly aggrieved South world that includes a lot of Muslims is going to acquire some level of prosperity or inclusion that's going to diffuse all of this, that the anger will sort of go away. Which of these is the end game here?
I think that, look, they think that they, you know, insofar as the ideology makes any sense at all, that they do have a view that they can achieve some kind of victory, that they will establish a caliphate. You know, to you and I, that sounds like a kind of crazy fantasy, but it's enough to keep these people to have a vision and to drive forward with it. I mean, just on back on the question of tackling it in terms of a terror threat, I think that one of the disturbing aspects of the Paris attacks is that if you talk to people, the intelligence people who try to monitor these things, they have generally thought that what we're most vulnerable to, particularly in Europe, is a small attack where it's one or two people who don't do much organization. But they thought that if it was a big plot with like 8-9 people, many months of preparation, multiple targets, they would pick that up because of the monitoring, because of the number of the infiltration of terrorist groups, because of electronic communications and so on. And they regularly roll up these plots. There are many more of them that are planned than actually succeed. So it's a bit concerning that you could have a big plot like this that went undetected for a long time and then actually blew up.
Is there any value, before we go, in just ignoring all of this?
Look, I don't think you can ignore it in a democracy, because your citizens will demand that you respond. But I think that you may have to live with it. I don't think that politicians can put it that way, because understandably voters will say, fine, you know, I'm not prepared to live with it, so I'm going to turn to somebody who can promise me that we can eradicate it. I don't think, you know, I think that it's been interesting for me actually to be in the US this week, having come from Europe, because there is still a demand for kind of absolute security here, which I think that the Europeans have sadly more or less given up on. I mean, I think we kind of accept that we are susceptible to terrorism and that you do your level best to sort of clamp it down, but it's going to come back. Whereas here, you see it in the refugee debate, the idea that if you could say, okay, no Syrian refugees will come in here, that will make you safe. And I think that...
It's preposterous. It's preposterous on its face.
Yeah, I think it is pretty preposterous, yeah, to be honest. I'm trying to be polite, but it's also it doesn't even make sense as a security measure, because
they're not the enemy. They're in fact fleeing the enemy.
They're fleeing the enemy, and also that, you know, if you're IS and you want to infiltrate terrorists into America, God forbid, you would send a French citizen or a Belgian citizen who can come in without need for a visa. You wouldn't ask for a Syrian refugee who would have to go through 2 years of vetting. It really doesn't make sense. But
as a foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times, the folks at ISIS must be looking at this debate in the United States and this "we will make you safe with security" and just be high fiving and laughing their heads off.
I don't know whether they do much high fiving, but I think that they, you know, the reason I hesitate about all this, you know, Third World War rhetoric is that. They definitely want. That's something they would agree with. And they, insofar as there is a kind of political goal behind attacks like Paris, it is to create no kind of middle ground, to radicalize everyone on every side, so that everybody in the community that feels attacked is asking for more radical measures. And that then makes it extremely hard to be a moderate Muslim if you feel that your whole community has been stigmatized and so on. And then that feeds the narrative that IS want, which is that there is an inevitable conflict between Muslims and the West. And that, you know, although there may be people in our societies who are now coming around to that point of view, if you think it through for a while, there can be no future, peaceful future for Europe, certainly, if that's the case. Something like 5% of the population of my own country are Muslims, 10% of the population of France are Muslims. You know, I live and work alongside these people. There's no need to believe that there's an absolute conflict. That's just not a description of reality. But to the extent that IS can create those ideas through these horrific attacks and then through the reactions they spark, that, I think, is insofar as there's a rationale, that's what it is. And so we really have to be careful about, well, obviously ramping up security measures and perhaps also attacking them in Syria and Iraq, not feeding this narrative that they want, which is that Islam and the West are heading for an inevitable showdown.
I think that's the key point, the feeding the narrative piece. And so far this week, they're doing a pretty good job, I would have to say. Gideon Rachman, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Gideon Rachman is chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film Brooklyn, starring Saoirse Ronan, about a young Irish woman torn between life and love in her native country and her new home in New York. Now playing.
Less than a decade after President George H.W. Bush signed the ADA in 1990, the Supreme Court issued a landmark ruling in the case of Olmstead versus L.C. It was a majority opinion of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg that declared that states must do everything in their power to integrate citizens with intellectual disabilities rather than segregating them in institutions. 16 years after the Olmstead ruling, a new investigation from the Minneapolis Star Tribune finds that little has changed for people with disabilities in the land of 10,000 lakes, anyway. Joining us is Chris Sears, reporter with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. What did you expect the changes to be, Chris, and what was the intent of the law that would give you an indication of what you were looking for?
Well, the intent of the law was that people with disabilities should have the same opportunities as people without disabilities. What we found in Minnesota is that 16 years had passed since this landmark ruling, and Minnesota had yet to even create a plan to actualize what was in that ruling. And we had thousands, and we still do, we have thousands of people in segregated facilities all over our state.
Let's hear the voice of Scott Rood, who's in his early 30s. He has Down syndrome, and he does have a job, and he spoke to one of your reporters.
You pick up garbage, pretty much, and you just put it in the bags. Garbage is always part bad for the environment. The reason I'm working there is trying to get into a community job.
Now, certainly there's no reason to believe that Scott is doing anything other than working as hard as he can, but he represents an employee in the sheltered workshop industry. Can you explain how that either does or does not represent the goal of the Olmstead ruling?
Right. So Scott is one of 12,000 people across our state that works in one of these sheltered workshops. And these are facilities where, you know, they bring people in with disabilities and they do menial tasks, and they're paid on a piecemeal basis, which means they're paid based on how quickly they do the work, and they're measured against people without disabilities. So if they only do the work half as fast as you or I would do the work, then they're paid half as much as you or I would be paid. And in some cases, we came across people that were paid 50 cents or a dollar an hour. And so it's discriminatory by its very nature. But the idea was, is they were supposed to transition to regular jobs in the community. They weren't supposed to be dead-end jobs that they would spend the rest of their lives working in. We met people who had been in state mental institutions, you know, 40 years ago, who were stuck on the same assembly lines that they were working on for the past four decades. As part of our series, we went to Vermont. Vermont has adopted a radically inclusive model of care for people with disabilities, and they've been remarkably successful. You know, their rate of employment for people with disabilities is the top in the nation. Vermont, back in 2001, decided they would stop all state funding of sheltered workshops. They would end it, no more. And 80% of the people that used to work in those workshops now have jobs in the community. They're making at least minimum wage.
What have you discovered has been the result of the group home program, which was used to deinstitutionalize so many people after the Olmstead ruling?
Well, group homes have a place. You know, there's no question that some people with severe disabilities and mental illnesses do need 24-hour care 7 days a week, which is supposed to be the reason for group homes. But what we found is that in many cases, people who were in group homes didn't actually need that level of care, and they could live in the community if they had supports to do so. And what we also found is that in many cases, at least in our state, people were sent hundreds of miles away from their home communities, from their families, from their loved ones, from their support networks, and they were sent to the far northern regions of our state to these isolated group homes in the woods, in the swamps.
Chris Sears is a reporter with the Minneapolis Star Tribune looking at the lack of success despite 16 years on since the Olmstead versus LC case, landmark decision. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The biggest private sector health insurer in the United States, United Healthcare, has warned that they might exit health insurance exchanges set up under the Affordable Care Act after losing more than $400 million this year. The company said it will make a decision in the first half of next year if they can continue to serve the public exchange markets in 2017. The announcement comes as a surprise because just last month, United's CFO said the company expected its exchange business to be strikingly better in 2016 and announced plans to expand the exchanges in 11 states. Joining me now, Zachary Tracer, healthcare reporter at Bloomberg. Zachary, do you think this $400 million loss that they claim is due to the exchanges, or are they trying to palm it off on the exchanges?
No, they've been pretty clear that they're losing hundreds of millions of dollars on the exchanges. And they think right now that they're going to lose something like $500 million next year. So clearly this business is not working out as they expected.
Why would they be losing so much money? What is it that they're – are they vulnerable in some way being so big? Is it something they're not doing? What's the story?
Sure. They've said people turning up on the exchange, people buying coverage on the Obamacare exchanges just tend to be a little bit sicker than the rest of the population. People are coming into the markets, you know, using healthcare, and then sometimes, you know, they'll stop paying premiums after they've gone to the doctor. So it's just not been a terribly profitable market for them.
And whose responsibility is to enforce premium payment? It's probably not the federal government's. It is United Healthcare.
Well, it's not anybody's responsibility. You can go buy a policy, you know, pay premiums for a few months, use some healthcare, and then, you know, stop paying for it, just like you'd stop paying for your cable bill. The problem is, a lot of the way these policies are designed right now, they sort of expect people to hold on to them for the year, and that's just not what's happening.
Outside of the Affordable Care Act, is it just there's a better, a different kind of class of people who are better bill payers, or there are simply people who can afford it, people who plan better? Why is this group of people so prone to not payment of bills?
Well, you know, when you and I get health insurance, we probably get it through our employers. So at Bloomberg, pays the bills, and they're signing a contract for a year at a time at least. So it's a different marketplace, and really, you know, one thing that insurers have run into is that this individual marketplace created by the Affordable Care Act is just not, it's like nothing they've ever seen before.
Is there any way for a consumer to basically do healthcare in that way? Buy a policy, go to the doctor, get whatever you need, and then ditch the policy, and then do it again the next time? Or is there some way of preventing that cycle from continuing?
Well, that's what some of the health insurers are saying is a big weakness of the Affordable Care Act, is that right now, because of the way the rules are set up, you can do exactly what you just described every year.
And there's no record that you've done that? There's no denial that a company can make because of non-payment of bills in the past?
That's right. One of the big changes that the Affordable Care Act made to the health insurance marketplaces in this country is making it so that you can't exclude people based on, you know, their past medical treatments or their health.
Zachary Tracer is a healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, time for the song and dance.
I want you to play dirty if you have to, but don't get caught.
Concentrate, focus, power.
If you put your effort and concentration into playing to your potential, to be the best that you can be.
I'm not good at that stuff. Instead, I thought I'd lead you in a psalm of inspiration. Our Father, who art in Calgary, bobsled be thy name.
On this Friday, we can actually count the days before the holidays are upon us. They're actually kind of upon us if you look at the movie titles. Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman are here. Rafer, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
So we've got a contrast. We've got a holiday movie. We've got kind of a scary adventure movie. And then we've got a franchise that's inevitable. Let's start with the movie The Night Before. Here's a clip.
What is this party called?
Why, you haven't heard? It's a Nutcracker ball.
The acts all around, but to no avail. What was this great party? And though year upon year they tried and they failed, they never did tire. They never did bail.
So The Night Before, are they going with year after year Christmas tradition here, or is this a one-off?
This is one of those Arrested Development type of comedies. It's the year after year tradition of partying hard on Christmas Eve. But of course, all these guys, Seth Rogen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Anthony Mackie, they've all grown up except for Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who still wants to keep going and find this mysterious nutcracker ball. I guess the idea of what's essentially a Christmas stoner comedy is kind of interesting, but it's the typical stuff you've seen. Seth Rogen takes a lot of drugs, a lot of mushrooms, plays with his face. You know, there's some vulgar sexual humor. I don't really think it works. The one thing I would say is it is pretty funny to see Michael Shannon play a mystical pot dealer named Mr. Green. He kind of steals the show. The rest of the film, not so great.
All right. The second movie, The Secret in Their Eyes. This is a little more serious. Not very much holiday about this, but an amazing cast. Here's a clip.
Let's kill him. Let's do it now before we lose him again. We just do it and that's it. He goes. Nobody will miss him. We'll make the case on the mosque without him and Carolyn gets the rest.
And then what? What would a few bullets get me?
a lifetime in jail so he dies without ever serving a day, and I spend the next 50 years envying him. Does that sound like justice to you?
This is an acting, you know, Godzilla versus Megalon in some sense. What do you think of the cast and what they're trying to accomplish here?
Well, that's Chiwetel Ejiofor and Julia Roberts, and I'm a big fan of both of them, and they're in a very serious movie here. It's a remake of an Argentinian film that won the Best Foreign Language Oscar a few years ago, and it's the story of two people who are working in law enforcement. She finds out that her daughter is killed by somebody who is an informant to the anti-terrorist organizations in America that have popped up after September 11th, and thus they can't really touch this person even though he raped and killed her daughter. It's a very serious movie. It's a very dark movie. And I have to say, it's very slow. I don't think the pacing works very well. By the time we start getting the big delivery moments at the end of the movie, they come boom, 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 and those are great. But everything before that, I think really the pacing needed to be changed. And their boss in the office, who's played by Nicole Kidman, I don't think her character was really fleshed out as well as she should have been either.
What do you think, Raver?
Yeah, it's not just slow. It's also really clumsy. This is one of those movies where I feel like every single detail in the film is just wrong. It's one of those films where the cops will be stalking their perp, and instead of flanking him and trying to capture him, they'll point at him and yell so that he can start running immediately. And also the whole time I kept thinking, you know, this is just some kind of 21-year-old punk kid, and you can't get these, you know, three FBI agents can't seem to nab him anywhere. It's just this very, very, as Kristen said, slow, and I think very morose, very hand-wringing, and very badly directed film.
That's lost a lot of, I mean, all of the nuance, it sounds like, of the Argentinian original.
Right, which, as Kristen said, won the Oscar. And this just is so, it's so melodramatic and so overdone. And I found the final plot twist, which I won't spoil, to be almost like a cruel joke. I think people at the screening I was at actually started giggling a little bit. They didn't want to, but you kind of couldn't help it.
Well, if you want melodrama, if you really want melodrama, I mean vintage melodrama, Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2 is here.
You're considered high-value targets to the capital. Our unit has been given a holo, a database that contains a detailed map of the capital and a list of every known pod. These pods can trigger anything from bombs to traps to mutts. Whatever they contain, they are meant to kill you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 76 Hunger Games.
76, but this is only number 3, right?
Yeah,
or 4, depending on how you look at it.
This is the last installment. This is it. This is the end. We say goodbye to Katniss Everdeen, Jennifer Lawrence. She's taking her rebellion all the way to the steps of the Capitol to fight President Snow, played by Donald Sutherland. I have found these films to be less and less impressive as they've gone along. They started out with such promise, based on these acclaimed novels by Suzanne Collins, and I feel that they've gotten slower, talkier, more thematically soupy as the movies have gone on, and I would say this is the worst of the series.
Right.
Endless, interminable. You know, we heard that clip with talk of pods. I don't know what pods are. I don't know what a mutt is, and I didn't really care throughout the entire film. And I'm sorry to say, I'm glad to see this this era coming to an end.
Worse than the Matrix sequels, Kristen?
Oh, that's not a fair question, John Hockenberry.
Right.
You know that's not
that's
a
true.
Fair question.
That's true.
But I have to agree with Rafer on this one. These most recent two films, I was a big fan of the first two, by the way. But the most recent two, they did that thing that I just can't stand, that Harry Potter also did, that Twilight also did. They took the last book in the trilogy, they split it into two movies, which they shouldn't have done. And that means there are a lot of scenes of people just sitting there conversing and explaining. And the first 45 minutes of this movie, there's not a single action scene. It's almost exclusively conversing, meeting, and explaining. And it's
like
just
watching
too much.
A radio show.
Exactly. But I will say, once the action starts happening, it becomes much more enjoyable. But it would have made so much more sense for the final two films to have just stuck to being one movie as they were in the book, just one story.
Well, maybe Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Schumer will reappear in some new franchise since they're
that.
Good friends now. The podcast.
This week on the podcast, we're dealing with a lot of listener mail, including somebody who's a little bit mad at Rafer for something he said on a podcast.
Ooh, uh-oh.
Big surprise.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks so much,
you
John.
You too, John.
So
support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Listen to these words. He had quite possibly been a foreigner, though not necessarily French, since to the people who had come after him and had almost obliterated all trace of his sojourn, anyone speaking the tongue with a foreign flavor or whose appearance or occupation was strange would have been a Frenchman, regardless of what nationality he might affirm, just as to his urban coevals, had he elected to settle in Jefferson itself, say, he would have been called a Dutchman. Those opening lines from William Faulkner's The Hamlet, lyrical, mysterious, take you right into a dark, overgrown world of whispers and memory. In them, you can hear Faulkner's mature command of rhythm, place, and time. Now try this. A bachelor apartment, a grand piano, a key in the lock, then a voice offstage. Yes, and let me tell you something, son. The more you count on them, the worse. Well, here we are. The door opens. Come in. That is the younger voice of William Faulkner. It's the opening lines from a newly published play written by a young Faulkner called Twixt Cup and Lip, about two young men and the saucy, untamed young woman who has captured both of their hearts. Here is the young, punchy, glib, and full of attitude Faulkner. Andrew Gooley found Twixt Cup and Lip in the University of Virginia Special Collections Library, and today the play was published for the first time in the Strand magazine, where Gooley is managing editor.
This was when he was a very, very young man. He was probably around 22 or 23. It came at a very tough time in his life because his childhood sweetheart, Estelle, had chosen another guy and married him, and Faulkner's heart was broken. At around that time, he had dropped out of school. He was working. He had these jobs that were odds and ends. And then, after trying to volunteer to fight in World War II, he came back to Oxford, Mississippi, and they offered a sort of a scholarship for veterans returning from the war to study there. And he was reading a lot of George Bernard Shaw. He was reading Anton Chekhov, and he was dabbling with a group of students who were interested in staging some plays over there. And this seems to be something that he wrote at that time when he was a student at Ole Miss.
Is this out of the Yoknapatawpha County zone that so much of his imaginary Americana takes place in?
This seems to be more of a jazz age flapper type of story with this emancipated woman who has two men around her little finger, and she's just very independent, and, you know, she drinks and she smokes, and the main character thinks that he's, you know, a very tough guy who knows how to tame her, but of course he's completely off, and she's just laughing at him and just knows how to manipulate everybody around her. When I read it, it reminded me of something written by Dorothy Parker or F. Scott Fitzgerald, or it reminded me of a play of Noel Coward. The interesting thing about it is, despite the fact that it was never published, if he had published or produced it at that time, it would have been looked at as one of the early jazz age carefree romantic stories.
He's taking characters and evoking a time in a way that comes much later in those other works.
Exactly. That's a great point. You know, of course, we have the jazz age stories of F. Scott Fitzgerald, Dorothy Parker. We have Noel Coward, and we have their plays and works, but this was ahead of its time in that it had some interesting turns of phrase. It was funny. It showed the characters as being, you know, flawed, yet at the same time endearing characters. Not many people were writing this type of theme around the 1920s.
Any evidence that this play was actually performed?
You know, sometimes when you'll come across something like this, you'll hear somebody say, oh, well, you know, this may have been lost to the reading public, but we have had an inkling that something like this did exist. Every scholar I've spoken to, and I haven't spoken to every single Faulkner scholar, was very, very surprised that this was completely lost, and they said that there is no evidence that this was ever performed.
But it is funny, and we don't associate Faulkner with a whole lot of chuckles in so many of his dark, dark novels, which really show the collision between a fading antebellum South and, you know, what came after the Civil War.
That's a very good point. So you have this dichotomy of this man who, on the one hand, was a, very much a product of the South. But on the other hand, he was a great chronicler, as you said, of the Southern decay. He was a chronicler of what he looked at as the original sin of the South and slavery, and how during his lifetime they persisted in treating blacks in a very atrocious way. This story did stay with me, and it reminds me of a short story that Anton Chekhov wrote titled The Bet. And there is a bet in this story, and there are some slight similarities here and there. So when I read this, my mind instantly flashed back to that Chekhov story, which it was a very different story, a very dark story. But there is a sort of a theme of how a bet can go off.
I'm a big fan of Faulkner, and I gather that this publication today will be a bit of a banner event for you at the end of the year.
I hope so. This has been a very good year for us in that we published an unpublished horror story by Tennessee Williams and a short story by F. Scott Fitzgerald during the summer. So ending the year with Faulkner is fantastic. This has been beyond my wildest dreams that we'd be able to publish this. And a big thanks to the William Faulkner Estate and Lee Kaplan, who is just a fantastic person to work with.
Andrew Gooley is managing editor of The Strand magazine, talking about a never-before-published William Faulkner play from the University of Virginia Special Collections Library called Twixt Cup and Lip. Thanks as always, Andrew.
Thanks a lot, John. Always good to be with you.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.